Is that my B107, sir?
As if you didn't know. And it makes awful reading, Palmer. You just love the army, don't you?
Oh, yes, sir. I just love the army, sir.
My first encounter with the Ypres file was, ironically, through one of the worst DVDs I ever purchased. In the early years of the format, £9.99 seemed impossibly cheap. Most discs were selling at £25 and felt worth the premium. So when I found the Ypres file for under a tenner, I assumed I had stumbled upon a bargain. I had not. The transfer was an absolute disaster. Otto Heller's widescreen composition had been hacked to pieces, Sidney J. Fury's adventurous framing was lost, and the whole film appeared fogged, cropped and lifeless. I moaned my way through the entire experience, convinced that DVD as a medium would self-destruct if this was in the standard it intended to set. And I buried the disc at the back of my collection, certain it did not deserve to be watched in that state. Years later, a proper restoration arrived, and with the opportunity to finally see the film as intended, and what I discovered was a minor revelation. A stylish, intelligent, atmospheric spy thriller, and for me, one of those rare films I would describe as perfect. Not because it's a towering masterpiece, but because I cannot find a single element I would remove, revise, or improve. It never grows old, never feels tired, and reveals something new each time I revisit it. Part of its allure lies in its distinctly unromantic portrait of Britain. I've always been drawn to the England of rain-damp pavements, grey skies, and faded grandeur, the side of country its citizens are often born wanting to flee. The Ypres file captures this vision perfectly, a subdued monochrome London of cold stone and weary institutions. Its appeal is its craftsmanship. The film is unapologetically cinematic, employing every stylistic tool available, yet never lapses into superficiality. The plot may not be groundbreaking, but the artistry elevates it. And yet, despite its quality and influence, I think the Ypres style is rarely discussed with the enthusiasm that it deserves, and what I hope to do with this podcast is convey why it stands apart, both within the 1960s spy boom and within British cinema more broadly.
Is this a promotion, sir?
Sort of.
Any more money?
Let's see. You're on 1,300 pay and allowances.
Yes, sir.
I'll try and get you 1,400.
Oh, thank you, sir. Now I can get that new infrared grill.
Well, save your money. Where you're going, you won't have much time for cooking. Dolby works his men, and he doesn't even have my sense of humour.
Yes, sir. I will miss that, sir.
In 1962, producers Albert Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman released Dr. No, the modestly budget first instalment of what would become one of cinema's most successful franchises. And, as an aside, I am going through the Bond films on bonus episodes, so do check the feed. Shot in Jamaica and starring the then relatively unknown Sean Connery, Dr. No became a cultural earthquake. Bond would come to define popular culture for decades. It spawned imitators, competitors, parodies, and counter movements, Combined with Cold War paranoia, the genre exploded across film and television. Spies were suddenly everywhere. It was, of course, a thoroughly male-dominated world, and one that today is a goldmine for retroactive offence. The sexism, stereotyping and political incorrectness are undeniable. Personally, I tend to view these things through the lens of context. To dwell solely on the politics is to miss the entertainment these films were there to provide. Jean Le Carré himself, a former intelligence officer, openly disliked Bond, dismissing it as frivolous and fantasy, and he wasn't wrong, but that was rather the point, I suppose. Producers inevitably sought alternatives to Bond, spy films without gadgets, volcano lairs or supervillains, but still with mass appeal. The realistic spy trend began with Le Carré's The Spy Who Came In From the Cold in 1963, which adapted into a starkly effective Richard Burton film in 1965. Shot with noir sensibilities and steeped in moral bleakness, it portrayed espionage as a bureaucratic nightmare rather than a glamorous adventure. It introduced George Smiley, later immortalised by Alec Guinness and Gary Oldman. Saltzman, meanwhile, was searching for a spy property far removed from Bond. He found it in the work of British author Len Deighton. Deighton's debut novel, The Ypres File, centred on an unnamed spy from Burnley, world-weary, bureaucratically oppressed and deeply unimpressed by authority. The novel was a sensation, equal parts espionage thriller and also class commentary. It was followed by Horse Underwater in 1963 and Funeral in Berlin in 1964. Deighton also wrote Cookbooks, a detail amusingly mirrored in Palmer's culinary interests on screen. Now, Saltzman saw opportunity, not competition. Bond may have dominated, but Deighton's novels offered a different flavour, cynical, distinctly British and already popular. Harry Saltzman's first choice to play Harry Palmer was Christopher Plummer, who turned it down for The Sound of Music. Next up was Richard Harris, who also declined, a decision he later deeply regretted. Michael Caine entered the picture thanks to his success in Zulu in 1964. Although hardly living a A-list life, he has an undeniable screen presence, and Saltzman saw him at dinner with Terence Stamp and impulsively offered him the role. The unnamed spy required a name for the film, and Saltzman wanted something ordinary, painfully ordinary in fact, and the result was Harry Palmer, arguably the least exotic name imaginable, and that indeed was the point. Palmer was an everyman, not a superhero. And Kane's Palmer is a fascinating contradiction. A disgraced army sergeant, not an officer, he represents the working class infiltrating a traditionally upper class institution. His crime, helping himself to army supplies in Germany, is hardly the stuff of Bond. His appearance is tidy but not flashy, suit, tie and iconic glasses, stylish but never exaggerated. He's cultured, he likes cooking, classical music and art, yet apathetic toward politics. He obeys orders only when it amuses him and treats authority with a cool, sardonic indifference. Palmer is an anti-establishment icon. Not through rebellion, but through his refusal to play the expected social game. He is quiet evolution of British society in the 1960s, class boundaries loosening, working class confidence rising, and the old establishment increasingly out of step. He's Albert Finney in Saturday Night and Sunday Morning by way of MI5. Now, Harry Saltzman wanted to go differently with The Ypres File, and he wanted to move the spy genre away from the fantastical world of 007. So enter director Sidney J. Fury. Now, Fury was young, he was experimental, and he understood that a Cold War film should feel claustrophobic, anxious and uncertain. So instead of clean, wide master shots, he built a visual grammar based on one of confinement. And his approach to the film was somewhat unconventional. It was filled with oblique angles, unusual framing, reflected imagery and compositions that made London feel alien and oppressive. And Saltzman, when he saw the footage, was absolutely appalled by what he actually saw. He was a famously impatient producer, and he clashed with Fury constantly. And it got so bad, apparently, that he said that Fury was ruining the picture, and he actually froze him out of the editing process. But I would argue that it's the direction of this film that makes the Ypres file. The rest of the team would include Otto Heller as the cinematographer, famous for The Lady Killers and Peeping Tom, Peter Hunt, who was editing, who was fresh off Bond, and Ken Adam and Paul Merton on production design, and John Barry on music. Although this was not an Eon production, the Bond fingerprints are everywhere, yet filled through something colder, stranger, and slightly more grounded. The cast would have Nigel Green as Dolby, Guy Dolman as Ross, and Sue Lloyd as Courtney. The Ypres file follows Harry Palmer, a sardonic working-class British intelligence officer operating in the murky, bureaucratic world of Cold War espionage. The story begins with the mysterious disappearance of several prominent British scientists, all experts in strategic military research. These kidnappings pose a serious national security threat, suggesting that a hostile power may be extracting sensitive information. Palmer works for a small, secretive intelligence unit led by the outwardly genial but tightly controlled Major Dolby and overseen by the more openly hostile Colonel Ross. Palmer himself is an unconventional operative, intelligent, observant, capable, but with a criminal past and a persistent tendency toward insubordination. His superiors do not fully trust him, yet rely on his skills. Palmer is assigned to investigate the latest disappearance, that of Professor Radcliffe, one of the kidnapped scientists who has unexpectedly resurfaced but appears mentally altered. Radcliffe soon dies under suspicious circumstances, deepening the mystery and raising questions about what has been done to him. As Palmer continues his investigation, he uncovers evidence of a sophisticated operation involving brainwashing and psychological conditioning. The kidnapped scientists are not being interrogated, they are being mentally reprogrammed, stripped of their autonomy, and used as tools for foreign intelligence services. During his inquiries, Palmer himself is kidnapped and subject to the same brainwashing process. He is imprisoned in a concealed location and forced to endure a disorientating sensory assault designed to erase his sense of identity and implant lethal commands in his mind. Though badly shaken, Palmer manages to resist complete conditioning by clinging to his awareness of who he is. And after his escape and apparent rescue, he begins to suspect that his superiors may be in collusion with the enemy.
It isn't usual to read a B-107 to its subject, Palmer, but I'm going to put you straight. Insubordinate. Insolent. A trickster. Perhaps with criminal tendencies.
Yes, that's a pretty fair appraisal, sir.
Back to you with the Ypres files, and something I think often gets missed is that the film's class politics aren't just written into the script, they're also written into the film's visual language. The camera, the framing, all understand the class dynamics that are at play during the film, and crucially, Harry Palmer understands this, even when he refuses to respect it. This is where Sidney Fury's direction, Otto Heller's cinematography, become quite radical. Because the Ypres file doesn't tell us Palmer is working class in the upper class system, it shows us relentlessly that this is visually the case. Space in the film equals power. Every time Palmer enters an institutional environment, be it Ross's office or Dolby's intelligence headquarters, he is visually diminished. The rooms are large, the ceilings are high, the furniture feels designed to keep people at a distance, And Fury never frames Palmer as someone who controls the space he occupies. He's either pushed to the edge of the frame, dwarfed by architecture, standing while others sit, or positioned beneath lamps, beams, or door frames. The upper classes own these spaces. Palmer is just a temporary visitor in there, tolerated because he's actually quite useful. This is class politics expressed through blocking and framing rather than dialogue. The film doesn't say, "You belong here." The framing has already done that for you. And also think about how we often see Palmer visually. Fury constantly shoots him through glass, banisters, railings, doorframe, lampshades, and foreground clutter. This is one of the most distinctive visual signatures of the film, and it's doing far more than creating paranoia. It's visualising class restriction. Palmer's view of the system is always meditated. He never has a clean line of sight, metaphorically or literally. Information is withheld and authority is filtered. The ruling classes move through the world cleanly. Palmer moves through it with resistance, and the camera makes us feel that friction constantly. Wide-angle lenses subtly distort space. They exaggerate depth, and they can make rooms feel slightly wrong, slightly hostile, almost unreal. And when Palmer is inside institutional environments, these lenses turn offices into abstract shapes, all lines, corners, and angles. The spaces feel designed for systems, not people. Bureaucracy therefore becomes almost architectural. And it's those without rank that are often swallowed by these environments. In the way Palmer is, his intelligence that we know he possesses doesn't protect him, his competence doesn't empower him, and the camera refuses to elevate him. Contrast this with Palmer's flat. It's modest, functional, and human scale, and the frame relaxes, the lenses are calmer, and the space feels more livable. And what's missing from the flat is just as important as what's present. There's no political posters, no pop culture signalling, no mod imagery, no Beatles record. Palmer refuses characterization. He won't perform his class identity for anyone, including the viewer. And the ambiguity unsettles the establishment of the film. They don't know where to place him, and systems built on hierarchy hate ambiguity. And there is another aspect to the film's visual grammar that really, I think, is important to understanding the film, because the Ipcris file almost never shoots Palmer heroically. No center frame dominance and no visual triumph. Even when he's right, and even when he's ahead of everyone else, the camera holds visual authority. This is a radical move, especially within the spy genre. It says competence does not equal power, intelligence does not equal status, and usefulness does not equal belonging. That's not just narrative cynicism, that is the class reality that the film creates. And class further plays a part in the film, in the bureaucracy that we see throughout the Ipcris file. Because the London presented here is not one that we commonly associate with the 1960s. It's not Beatles, not clubs or Carnaby Street. It's concrete, damp mornings, faded architecture, offices filled with grievance rather than glamour. Indeed, I actually laughed at one stage in the film with its, I suppose you would call her the Money Penny equivalency, when Palmer goes into an office and this is a woman just sat there with a cigarette hanging out her mouth, who's probably been working the same job for 30 years and religiously, you can tell, takes her lunch hour. And we know that Palmer is intelligent and observant and capable, and he is perpetually underestimated by the people who outrank him. And those people, like people like Colonel Ross and Dalby, represent the entrenched British establishment, educated, confident, and quietly condescending. And the Cold War of this film isn't thrilling missions or daring rescues. It's rooted in something far more recognisable. There's paperwork to do, endless paperwork, petty rivalries and turf wars for departments. And the intelligence world shown here is a place where People compete for budgets, their superiors undermine each other, information is hoarded in boxes, and there's petty feuds shaping national strategy. This is espionage as office politics.
Good morning, Dorbyn.
Good morning, sir.
I've just read your T-104.
I thought that might speed your arrival.
It did. It's a pity you lost, Radcliffe. Still, we were expecting something of that sort.
I hope you're not imputing negligence to my department.
My dear chap, there's no question of that.
Let me put you in the picture, Dolby. The killing of Radcliffe's guard has verified our suspicions.
For some time now, we've had a section investigating the brain drain. What's worrying them upstairs is that too many government scientists are leaving their jobs at the peak of their careers. They cease to function.
You've checked on them, of course.
Naturally. We've checked on them all. 126 have left in the past 2 years. 107 had fair enough reasons to go. Better facilities, better pay. 3 defected to the other side.
And the other 16?
17 with Radcliffe. 17 top men. What defies the laws of probability is that none of them had a rational explanation for quitting.
But Radcliffe didn't quit. He was lifted.
Exactly. Now we think we've got our first real lead. And I want you to get Radcliffe back.
I'll try, of course.
That's not good enough. If you don't get him back, the people upstairs might have to close you down.
Now, wait a minute. This department was set up for counter-espionage, not security grade one surveillance on people like Radcliffe.
Well, neither were Wilson's or Roberts' departments, but I put them on S1 duties.
They were War Office, I'm Home Office.
Oh, I'm aware of that, Dolby. I set you up, remember? And you got a very good job for a passed over major, haven't you?
What I love about that scene is that it isn't loud. It's not angry. It's controlled, understated. I think, very British performance of civility. But underneath that surface, you can sense the enormous tension. Ross believes Dolby methods are sloppy, and Dolby believes Ross is interfering. And it's a scene that's often overshadowed by the flashier moments of the film, but it is also absolutely crucial to its narrative, because the Ypres file argues that intelligence failures isn't about failures coming from evil masterminds, but becoming from bureaucratic disputes. And a nation's safety, the film suggests, hangs not on kind of heroes like we'd expect in the kind of James Bond vein, but on old school establishment men who don't want to see their authority challenged. I also think that this scene, and indeed the film, is indicative of another kind of a historical truth that is in the Ypres file. And one, I think, that brings the film into sharper focus, because by the mid-1960s, Britain was most definitely no longer a superpower. The empire had shrunk. India, its jewel, had gone. Suez, in 1956, had exposed the uncomfortable reality that Britain could no longer act independently on the world stage without American improvement. Militarily, economically, and politically, the country was adjusting, awkwardly, to a new, reduced role. And yet, culturally, Britain was projecting a newfound confidence. James Bond arrived precisely at this moment of national uncertainty, and he performed an almost therapeutic function. Bond didn't just entertain, he reassured. He placed Britain back at the centre of the world. In the Bond films, British intelligence doesn't react to global events, it directs them. A single British agent can outwit global criminal organisations, dismantle enemy networks, and save civilization from disaster. Bond offers Britain as the saviour of the world, suave, decisive, omnipotent. But the Ypres file, and the broader tradition that includes Jean Le Carré, refuses to indulge this fantasy. Instead of restoring Britain's imperial confidence, it reflects Britain's post-imperial reality. In this world, Britain isn't leading the Cold War, it's navigating it, carefully, often clumsy, and sometimes from the sidelines. The intelligence service in the Ypres Files don't feel like the nerve centre of global power. They feel overstretched, underfunded, and riddled with internal tension. Their offices are cramped, their equipment looks second-hand, and their authority is constantly contested. Decisions aren't made with swagger. They're hedged, delayed, and passed up the chain of command. And crucially, the scale of the film reflects that diminished position. Unlike Bond, the Ypres Files doesn't hop from Jamaica to Switzerland to Japan. It doesn't globetrot. It doesn't dominate international space. Instead, it stays close to home. The Cold War here isn't a global chessboard being commanded by London. It's a series of small, anxious manoeuvres taking place in offices, warehouses, car parks and anonymous streets. This is Britain as a nation slightly adrift, still important, still involved, but most definitely not in control. And the sense of drift is reflected not just in the story, but in the film's obsession with bureaucracy. Forms are filled in, permissions are requested, chains of command argued over, files reviewed, reviewed and quietly buried. The real battles in the Ypres Files aren't fought with guns, they're fought over paperwork. Who authorises the operation? Which department takes responsibility? Whose jurisdiction is this? Who signs off the expenses claims? The petty administrative machinery becomes a metaphor for Britain itself, a former imperial power still clinging to produce the hierarchies that once supported global dominance, but now mostly generate friction and delay. In Bond, Britain's bureaucracy barely exists. M gives an order and the world, and Bond does the rest. In the Ypres File, the bureaucracy is the world, and it doesn't bend for anyone. Harry Palmer's frustration with former superiors and petty authority isn't just character detail, it's political commentary. He operates within a system that has inherited the rituals of power without retaining its substance. And the rituals remain, the certainty does not. And that's why the film feels so grounded, so earthy and so weary. It understands that Britain in the 1960s wasn't saving the world. It was negotiating its place within it. Carefully and anxiously, and often through the dull grind of administrative process rather than heroic action. And the Ypres Files doesn't mourn the loss of status, but it doesn't romanticise it either. It simply accepts it, and in doing so, it offers a more honest portrait of Britain at the moment of transition. Country learning, reluctantly, that power had become something smaller, messier, and far less glamorous than it once imagined.
And what do you make of that?
Well, if I could have a bit more equipment, sir, I might be able to make something out of it. I could play around with it in various ways.
Well, keep it within reason.
It must mean something.
Hardly worth a TX-82, though, was it, Palmer? Open a file on it, Chico.
Right, sir.
Chico, what?
And we still have to find Radcliffe, gentlemen. That means more legwork and fewer inspired hunches. Get on with it.
One of the most persuasive sensations in the Ypres File is paranoia, not as an event, but as an atmosphere. It's in the air of the film, it seeps into every interaction, every exchange of information, and every supposedly routine task. This is entirely appropriate for the period the film emerges from. The Cold War was not defined solely by open confrontation, but by uncertainty. The enemy was rarely visible. Threats were often abstract. Loyalty could be assumed. And the most dangerous actions were frequently carried out by people who appeared respectable, familiar, and entirely unthreatening. In this world, paranoia is not irrational. It is a form of survival. Unlike Bond, where danger announces itself flamboyantly, the Ypres File presents a reality in which the greatest risk lies in misplaced trust. Allies may not be allies, superiors may not be loyal, everyone's own perception may be compromised, and crucially, the film never allows the audience a position of comfort or omniscience. This is where Fury's direction and the style he adopts becomes essential, not decorative, not stylistic for its own sake, but philosophical, and perhaps, just maybe, it's something that Harry Saltzman just simply didn't quite understand when he was choosing him to be director. And Fury complements the film's paranoia by withholding key information from us. We are rarely allowed to see a scene clearly. cleanly or in full. Characters are framed behind objects, faces are partially obscured. Key conversations are shot through railings and door frames or cluttered foregrounds, as we discussed before. And these things do two things simultaneously. Firstly, it replicates the experience of surveillance. We feel like we are watching something we are not meant to see, overhearing fragments, glimpsing partial truths, piecing together meaning from incomplete information. We feel like we are watching something we are not meant to see, overhearing fragments, glimpsing partial truths, piecing together meaning from incomplete information. Second, it denies us the authority to judge confidently. We cannot fully read people. We cannot fully trust appearances. Even when we are close to a character, something remains hidden. This visual obstruction becomes a metaphor for Cold War intelligence itself. Information is never complete, motives are never transparent, and certainty is always provincial. The direction reinforces one of the film's central ideas, that no one is exempt from scrutiny. In many spy films, the audience is given a privileged position. We know who the villain is long before the hero does. We are assured that order will be restored, and the Ypres file refuses us this reassurance. Instead, it cultivates ambiguity, conversations trail off, motivations are hinted at rather than explained, and authority figures speak in polite half-statements that conceal as much as they reveal. The viewer is left in the same position as Palmer, alert, cautious, and never fully certain. Even the act of communication is treated as suspect. Files go missing, documents are incomplete, messages are intercepted, and orders are phrased vaguely enough to allow denial later. And this is where the paranoia becomes institutional to the film. It suggests that paranoia is not merely a psychological condition, it is a structural feature of Cold War systems. Intelligence organisations thrive on secrecy and plausible deniability. No one ever knows the whole picture, and no one has ever meant to either. Fury's style mirrors this fragmentation perfectly. By refusing visual clarity, he forces the audiences to experience the same anxiety as the characters, the sense that something vital is always just out of the frame. And when betrayal finally surfaces, it doesn't feel shocking. In a way, it feels completely inevitable, because the film has trained us not to trust anyone. In the Ypres file, paranoia isn't hysteria either. It is a logical response to a world built on secrets, half-truths, and quiet manipulation. And Fury's direction ensures that this paranoia is not just understood intellectually, but felt rhythmically, visually, and emotionally. You don't watch the Ypres file from a safe distance, you inhabit it with a degree of uncertainty. And in doing so, the film captures something essential about the Cold War experience, a constant low-level anxiety where the real danger is not knowing who or what you can afford to trust.
Well, I hope this won't take too long. I have an appointment for dinner.
All right. There's a dead American agent in my flat.
You killed him?
Someone is trying to frame me.
Now, who would want to do a thing like that?
Impossible to talk about the Ypres file without also talking about the music of John Barry, because I think he does something as radical as Sidney Fury does with the camera. Barry was, by 1965, already indelibly associated with James Bond. He had created one of the most recognisable musical identities in cinema history. Bold, brassy, and very confident, the Bond theme doesn't just accompany action, it asserts its authority. It reassures the audience that control will be maintained, that the danger will be stylistically overcome. But in the Ypres file, Barry strips that away. What he composes instead is a score built on hesitation, restraint, and ambiguity. It doesn't announce heroism, it doesn't promise resolution, it just unsettles gently. From the opening moment, the music tells you this is not a world of triumph or certainty. The main theme is slow, measured, and almost weary. It carries a sense of melancholy rather than excitement, as if the Cold War itself had grown tired of its own endless tensions. And central to this mood is Barry's use of a cymbalan, an instrument rarely heard in British cinema at the time. Its sound is metallic, percussive, and faintly alien. It evokes Eastern European without spelling it out, an abstract suggestion at the other side of the Iron Curtain rather than a caricature of it. And the music doesn't swell or soar, it taps, repeats, lingers. And this choice is crucial because the Ypres file is a film obsessed with mental process, with thinking, remembering, observing and doubting. And Barry's music mirrors that internal focus. Rather than driving the narrative forward, it circles it, probes it and worries at it. And in many scenes, the film score feels less accompanying, more like a psychological commentary on what's going on. When Harry Palmer tails suspects through London Street, the music doesn't escalate into pulse-pounding suspense. Instead, it maintains a steady, watchful presence. The tension, not from speed or volume, but from repetition, notes reoccur, slightly altered, as though the music itself is checking and rechecking information, just as Palmer is doing. The restraint reinforces the film's grounded tone. Espionage here is not a series of climactic moments, it is a slow accumulation of unease, and Barry understands and refuses to provide the emotional release audiences might expect. Importantly, the score also reinforces the film's sense of confinement. Much like Fury's visual style, Barry avoids expansiveness. There are no sweeping orchestral statements that suggest open spaces or grand adventure. The music feels enclosed, boxed in, and intimate. Even when the stakes are enormous, the theft of scientific knowledge and the manipulation of mind, the score keeps a very focused rhythm. We feel close to the characters, close to their anxieties, and close to the limitations they are under. This becomes especially powerful during the brainwashing sequence. Barry doesn't overwhelm the senses with bombast. Instead, the music becomes fragmented, disorientating, and almost mechanical. It pulses and then recedes, refusing to settle into a comforting rhythm. Combined with Fury's aggressive editing and distorted visuals, the score contributes a sense of identity being dismantled piece by piece. What's striking is how quiet much of the film's most intense music is. Barry isn't afraid of silence. He allows space between notes and he lets moments breathe. And he lets these moments become uncomfortable as a result. That silence is not natural. It's threatening. And I can really attest to this, actually. I was recently a complete maniac came up to me absolutely shouting and screaming and then just suddenly stopped talking and was staring at me. And it was one of the most uncomfortable, scariest moments of my entire life. And actually, when I was looking at the listening to the music of the Ypres file, it did kind of remind me of that, like you are just waiting for something to happen before the music comes back in. Barry also uses the score to blur moral boundaries. There is no musical distinction between good and bad. The same themes drift through intelligence offices, surveillance operations, and moments of supposed safety. And this reinforces the idea that no space is truly secure in the film and no authority is inherently trustworthy. Unlike Bond, where musical cues largely signal danger or reassurance, the Ypres file denies us that guidance. The music refuses to tell us how to feel or what is going on in the film, and it's entirely keeping with its worldview. Because the Cold War, as presented here, is not a narrative of clear sides and bold victories. It is a prolonged state of anxiety where success is provisional and clarity is rare. And long after individual scenes fade, the mood continues to linger. The sense of unease persists. And the score leaves us not exhilarated, but unsettled, which is precisely how the Ypres file wants us to feel. And in rejecting the heroic bombast of Bond, Barry aligns himself fully with the film's deeper purpose. He gives sound an uncertainty, he makes suspicion musical, and in doing so, he helps transform the Ypres file from a conventional thriller into something far more distinctive, a true attempt at making a Cold War film. And I think it's really interesting because I listen to a lot of film soundtracks, and this is one of the John Barry scores that I don't like to listen to. I find it never settles. It's never, it doesn't have the kind of the sweep of his other stuff. And I think that's really interesting that, you know, a lot of soundtracks you can listen to away from the film and just enjoy them on their own terms. And this is certainly something that I don't do with the Ypres file.
Jock Carswell got somewhere with the Ypres file and he showed it to me. I am being framed by whoever killed him.
Can you prove any of this?
The file was stolen from my desk.
By Grantby, of course.
No. Ross.
Ross?
He once asked me to microfilm the Ypres file.
Why didn't you tell me this before?
Because he would have put me back in jail.
What time does your cleaning woman arrive in the morning?
About 9.
It gives you exactly 12 hours. Leave me to sort this out. You, lose yourself.
The final confrontation in the Ipcris file, I think, is a really brilliant finale to the film because it brings together everything that the Ipcris file has been about. The brainwashing, the questions of loyalty, the theme of identity, and Palmer's own integrity. Palmer is recovering from his torture. He's disorientated but regaining clarity, and Dolby arrives, pretending to rescue him, still wearing the veneer of calm authority. But Palmer, now fully alert, notices something. Dolby's explanation simply doesn't work. It doesn't add up. The timing and everything is off. Earlier in the brainwashing chamber, Palmer was conditioned to kill a specific target on command. This is the moment the film has been building toward. Dolby tries to manipulate him into following the implanted order, cleverly, subtly, as though he's offering guidance rather than giving a command. He expects Palmer is going to obey, but Palmer has been fighting the conditioning, and this is where I think Michael Caine delivers one of his most controlled, powerful performances of his career. His face twitches, his hands tremble, he rubs his temple. The physical memory of the torture created to break him in, but he resists slowly, painfully, with sheer force of will. He refuses to surrender his mind to an authority that simply doesn't deserve it. And I think why this scene matters is because there's no explosion, no stunts, no chase. There's simply a man refusing to let himself be used. It's the perfect encapsulation of what the Ipcris file is about. There's no glamour, no heroics, but a quite internal battle for a man to remain oneself. And in the end, Palmer rejects the entire structure of manipulation from Dolby, from Ross, from the system that treats him like a fool. In the end, Palmer rejects the entire structure of manipulation from Dolby, from Ross, from the system that treats him like a fool. But the film has one slightly cruel turn, which is his final line.
I was counting on you being an insubordinate bastard, Palmer.
You used me as a decoy. I might have been killed or driven stark raving mad.
That's what you're paid for.
This exchange also embodies so much of what the Ipcris file is all about. At the end of the day, he is simply just a paid employee of a governmental organisation that probably won't learn from this lesson, that will retain its power structures. And Palmer, like the rest of the minions, is just a paid employee from a nation that will never really know what he has sacrificed. So that's going to be it for this episode of the Ipcris File. Many thanks for listening. I will be back next week. If you want to email me, you can get in contact with me at 24framescast@gmail.com. You can also follow me on X at Thomas24FC. I will be looking at some other kind of social media platforms I need to kind of get myself on. I might even start an Instagram account dedicated to the show. So many thanks for listening as always, and I'll be in contact soon. Bye-bye.